Today's episode is part two of our interview with Darren Vo, president of Icomia. Our first was very interesting. This is equally so. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, and welcome to the Boat Princess podcast. My name is Nikki Vo, and I'm your host. I am a boat owner, a marina owner, a director on the Marina Industries Association, and a huge advocate for boating. In this series, I'm sharing the stories from every nook of the boating industry with the intention of encouraging more women to join me and for more women to get behind the helm too. I want to share the experience and opportunities of boating, of the boating industry, and I want you to join me as I bring the conversations and answer all the questions you've had. Boating is not just for the glamorous and rich and famous. It's full of beautiful and interesting people making the most of our natural environment and getting out there, enjoying the waterways. So let's let off the lines, take over the helm, and escape to the world of boating. It's not a one-size-fits-all we're talking about here. This study has revealed that different solutions are better for different styles of craft. Is that the way we're looking at this?
Yeah, look, I think if we look to what the outcomes are, and I think let's just sort of get down to it, there is no one-size-fits-all because you do need to look at the specific use cases. However, if you look at the data set that we've used, which is the reflection of the vast majority of the industry, then for normal recreational use, the best way to decarbonize the recreational marine industry is through the use of sustainable drop-in fuels. And the reason being is that there is, and one of the things that was uncovered is that in looking at each of the alternatives, the amount of embodied carbon within the manufacturing processes, particularly for batteries, is substantial. And because the operating hours are so low, you can't offset it. And so in some respects, there are numerous examples in the study where the carbon footprint of the electrical alternative, recognizing that it only had 20% of the performance, has a higher carbon footprint than the fossil fuel alternative. Now that was a great surprise to
yeah.
us. And in fact, probably the craft that stood out to me as the most surprising was actually the sailing yacht.
Okay.
And the reason being is that the average engine hours on a sailing yacht is only 28 hours a year.
Of course, because they're using wind.
Because you want to get the sails up, which is, you know, the best way to decarbonize a sailing yacht
fantastic.
Is to use your sails.
But, yeah.
But as a consequence, you know, the ability, the embodied carbon within it. And so once again, sailing yachts have got a long life. Battery life is limited. So you have to replace the batteries due to the term. And so as a consequence, the carbon footprint of that alternative was significant compared to the alternatives. But the drop-in fuel alternative, you know, sees dramatic reductions. In fact, if we had a pathway for the recreational marine industry today that gave us the sustainable fuels that we need, then we'd meet the Paris Agreement. And the reason we would was that the sustainable fuels, and I'll use the US figures because, you know, I've got them to hand in terms of they have great access to data in the US.
And they've got volume there at boating. So,
and look, in most respects, the US market or North American market reflects 50% of the global recreational marine industry in round figures. So there's about, I think there's 12.5 million boats in the US. There's about 30 million worldwide, but there's 12.5 million existing boats in the US. Now they sell 250,000 new boats per year. So quick math says that it'd take 25 years to replace the existing fleet over time. And the existing fleet's got at least a mean life of about 20 years. So if you really want to decarbonize, you're going to have to come up with a solution that decarbonizes the existing fleet. The new fleet has a very little impact on the overall position. And so sustainable drop-in fuels, obviously, that you can put into the existing engines and utilize them, are clearly a great way to decarbonize existing fleet. But importantly, the conclusion of the report, which was to deal with new craft, came to the same conclusion. And so in that sense, there's a symmetry between that, and it sort of creates this outcome that says sustainable fuels. Now, we did test, as an example, a higher PwC.
Okay.
And we used 156 hours, and we assumed that the PwC would have a battery that enabled it to operate for, you know, under 2 hours. So in other words, a higher operator could let it out for an hour, it could run through, you had some contingency in the way that it was done, and then it had come back fast charge, and maybe there was, you had to have two craft or something like that. But in that particular case, that's a great example of where electrical solutions work really well.
Yeah.
Because then you can, then it's clean, it doesn't have much noise, it's all of those sorts of, I mean, there's no emissions coming out of a tailpipe and all those sorts of things for that particular circumstance. And so providing you can work with the functionality of it, we tested that as a use case. And because the engine hours were higher, then you could offset it, particularly if you were prepared to have a smaller battery, because so much of the carbon's in the battery. So like I said, no one size fits all, but to decarbonize the recreational marine industry to meet the Paris Agreement, the answer's sustainable drop-in fuels.
And the conclusion on the sailing yacht was?
Same thing, sustainable drop-in fuel.
Yeah, even for a sailing yacht.
Even for a sailing yacht, because yeah. the carbon footprint of the electric alternative over an LCA analysis, cradle to grave, was greater than, you know, the alternatives. And so, you know, the sustainable fuels really step forward as the solution to those issues.
Yeah. So I guess really simplifying it down, thinking about all of those, if we say 12.5 million in the US boats,
12 and a half million, yeah.
Sitting there, to take all of their current engines out of them and replace them with an alternative, you're immediately taking away, you've made a massive carbon imprint by creating those engines, and keeping that engine going with a biofuel or a sustainable fuel is far, far better than creating a new engine, which uses a whole bunch of carbon in doing that, and then placing it in the boat and disposing of the old one as well. That's what you've got to think about, isn't it?
Yeah,
because boats go for so long.
And we like to call it the carbon balance sheet. So in other words, the carbon used in the manufacturing of the existing fleet has already been discharged into the atmosphere.
Mm.
But as a consequence, we have an asset. The embodied carbon in the craft that's made is actually an asset. So the best way to reduce carbon is to use that as much as possible in terms of longevity, and use it for as long as possible. So I guess to put a fine point on it, that if you had an engine failure, as an example, within a yacht that was 20 years old, what propulsion system should you replace it with? Well, you should replace it with an internal combustion engine that uses sustainable fuels.
See, that's really fascinating.
I know,
isn't it?
It's a surprise, but yeah. That is because the carbon footprint of making that particular type of engine, unless there's unless there's a moonshot, someone all of a sudden invents a battery that's got massive energy density and a life of 30 years,
yeah.
Then, you know, everything changes and
of
you'd
course.
Have to redo it, right?
Yeah.
But based on the technology that exists today
yeah.
and what Ricardo, as an expert consultant, projects the technology to be over the next 10-odd years, then, you know, the conclusion of the report is that sustainable fuels used through internal combustion engines for the vast majority of the fleet is the solution. Now, you know, this isn't about trying to stifle innovation in all sorts of different areas because, for instance, if you look at, there may be use cases where electrical alternatives are the preference for other reasons.
Yep.
For instance, that it might be about noise, or it might be operating in an environment where you're going, well, we don't want any form of emissions out of tailpipes and things like that. But I think the important issue about this is that when you do an LCA analysis, it's all very well to say, well, during the operating phase, we're not making any emissions. But when you look at the supply chain, when you look at where the electricity is coming from, where you look at how the trucks and ships and various other things that move these materials around the world, where all the carbon emissions are in that regard, then you're going, well, let's just, the LCA forces a degree of brutal honesty in what the carbon emissions are over an entire lifetime.
Yeah.
And I think that it's very easy to sort of look at one piece and go, well, this piece is really good, but it's in the recreational boating sense, it's how did we get there and what are the consequences of actually manufacturing the product is probably the most important thing. So
I think there's also I think we should actually talk about as well, which is an issue that's now occurring in cars that have had electrical engines put in them, that there does come a point where the car is only worth X value, but the replacement batteries are a lot more than that. So that same thing is going to happen in boats at some point as well, especially yachts, because yachts can go on for a very long time and their value is not necessarily as high as a motor yacht because of the engines, funnily enough, because a lot of the expense in a motor yacht is the motors. So that's an honesty conversation as well too, isn't it? That there is, again, with current technology, there is that issue. That I've been talking to New Zealanders and they've told me that electric cars are being abandoned because their battery cost is so much greater than the value of the car, and obviously the impact of that is not good at all. So,
well the carbon, the LCA carbon footprint of that would be extremely poor. And I think it's a really interesting one, because electric cars, for instance, providing that you are doing a lot of miles and that the source of the electricity that you're using, you know, if you're being able to charge it from home and you've got solar panels and all of those sorts of things and you're using it for a lot of miles, then there's a, you know, high probability that you will offset the carbon footprint of the manufacturing process and that it'll be a great solution. But if you're not using the car very often, and the electricity that's actually powering it is from coal-fired power stations.
Well, yeah.
And then, because don't forget, I think one of the interesting things is that the batteries in a car and batteries generally, the technology is that they have a certain life, which is a reflection of the number of charging cycles, but it's also, it's not just that, it's also they have a certain life. Mm. And so even an underutilized car, the battery will deteriorate over time, and those times are a lot less than the normal expected life of cars. Now, look, I'm no expert in cars, so all of this is anecdotal.
Well, yeah,
I think that when you look at boats and we look at the science, because we do have the data now with the boats from this study, that if you look at the longevity of boats, which are very long living, and then you look at the alternative technologies that are available today, then it's pretty clear, given that we have very low engine hours and we have you know, a lot of carbon in the manufacturing process, I think it does help us guide policymakers towards having a focus on two things. One is supply chain, really, really trying to understand the supply chain side and assist us in improving the supply chain. And the second thing is help us build a pathway to sustainable fuels.
And I guess I may be a bit naive in saying this, but biofuels, presumably a lot more countries can produce that. I mean, obviously fossil fuels only come from certain areas and then they're transported to other countries to use them. So is that the case? Can biofuels be produced by many more countries?
They can. And I think there's a number of important parts to it. There's actually a certain maturity in the manufacturing and development of these fuels in the US. Again, you can actually buy sustainable fuels at some marinas in the US today.
How awesome is that?
And when I say sustainable fuels, there's you know, e-gasolines, you know, made from waste feedstocks or cooking oils or various other things, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But there's also e-gasolines that are being developed, which are you know, orientated towards running, you know, the equivalent of petrol type engines versus diesel. So the technology to develop these fuels is there. We know how to do it. And in some respects, you know, at the chemical level, you know, we take, if you think about what happens with oil refineries, we take crude oil and then break it down and make it into fuels that we can use. So we take it from a very dense and complex oil and we break it down into the parts that we use in biofuels. In a lot of respects, we're almost building them up from the raw components, you know, and from carbon and hydrogen, nitrogen, different things to build it up into the fuels we need. But it's a very similar process. But the source of the feedstock for fuels is probably our biggest challenge. We don't want to have the circumstance where, for example, we start deforesting rainforests, yes, to grow palm oil, because that's, because obviously the forests themselves are doing a lot on decarbonisation for us and producing breathable oxygen. So, deforestation to deliver this outcome is not the answer. Likewise, displacement of food production could be problematic. You know, we don't want certain countries or that are producing certain types of foods to go, well, I'm not going to make that anymore, because I want to build these, I want to grow these particular crops that are good to make sustainable fuels. But there are waste feedstocks that come from the agricultural process. In other words, the parts of the plants that are harvested that we don't eat,
okay,
that we can use. There are, as an example, the cooking oils that are used around the world, that they get recycled and they're very easy to translate into these processes, the way that they're worked through. So the supply chain for sustainable fuels is a great challenge, just like the supply chain for wind power or solar or hydro or nuclear and all that, all of the different alternatives. They're all a challenge. And I think that this comes back to the core message. There is no one size fits all, but in the recreational marine industry, sustainable fuels is the answer. And I'll just add one more point. And that one more point is that, as an example, when I said earlier that boats and planes have got a lot in common, well, fuels are the thing they've got in common as well. Yeah. So I read recently a study, a pathway document that was basically a joint venture between the CSIRO and Boeing, which was actually looking at the pathway to create sustainable airline fuels in Australia and how that could be actually produced. Now, I think in round figures, I think the airline industry in Australia used something like 10 billion litres of fuel a year, something around that.
The boating industry then.
I think we're around the 200 to 300 million litres a year, right across the whole of all of our boating and things like that. So, airline fuels, that sort of kerosene smell that you smell with those sort of, that's a particular type of hydrocarbon. And there's no reason why the same refinery couldn't be making sustainable gasoline or petrol for boats and sustainable diesel for use in certain types of transport and recreational boats. So there is absolutely the pathway. What we need is policymakers to actually acknowledge it, to understand it, and then as a consequence to create policy frameworks around supporting it.
Yeah.
And I think that, back to the COP28 that's going on at the moment, we need all these solutions.
Mm.
We need all these solutions.
And just while we're on that subject, I guess we do need to make our audience aware of exactly, whilst we're making these changes and we need to make the changes, we do as an industry have very little impact in terms of fuel carbonisation, don't we?
The recreational marine industry's contribution to global greenhouse gas emissions on an annual basis is 0.1%.
Yeah.
We are 1,000th of it. So if we decarbonised 100% tomorrow, it really wouldn't move the dial. The big users are transport and energy production, around sort of 20 to 40% sort of sectors each type thing. So that's where the majority of it is. But we have a responsibility to do it, as all industries do. We have a responsibility to do our part and to evaluate what needs to be done, because we need to also inform our policymakers and regulators as to how you actually do it for our industry, so that they can work with us.
Well, plus I think as an industry, because of that big white boat image going fast, policymakers tend to look at us as a big bad consumer. And that they therefore need to put policy in place to restrict us. That's why we need to also, as an industry, step forward and give them information to show them what we actually do and what would actually make a difference.
Yeah. So I think you've raised a really important point, because I don't think there is that perception about what boating is, we talked about before. But I don't see boating as discretional, because I think that the reason being is that, and we saw it during COVID, is that when, you know, when the future was uncertain, when, you know, everyone's lives and businesses and jobs were at risk, people gravitated towards the water, they gravitated towards boating, they gravitated towards outdoor activities. And I think this comes back to, I guess, this fundamental principle that we always talk about is that boating enriches people's lives, that being in, on or around water fundamentally changes human beings. It, you know, it gives you a sense of well-being, it reduces your cortisol, it increases your serotonin. You know, that great book by Wallace J. Nichols, Blue Mind, was probably the most accessible and contemporary explanation of it. But there's enormous science that goes to prove that that is the case. And as a consequence, it's of great value to society. Recreational boating matters. It has huge levels of participation around the world. It transcends age. It transcends culture. It's a, you know, it's extraordinarily popular activity. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of people around the world engage in recreational boating. So as a consequence, we need to fight for it. You know, we need to fight and defend our industry and its participation. We need to share this wonderful lifestyle with other people. And as a consequence, you know, the decarbonisation approach, we've taken this because we see it as a regulatory vulnerability of our industry, where decisions are made based on inadequate information. Well, there's no excuse now. There is no excuse. We have the answers. We have the science. We have the research, and we know what needs to be done. So we need to get that message out, and we need to talk to as many people as possible, both in industry, but also the regulators and policymakers and the consumers, to inform them. And I guess this is the first step. You know, we've done this massive study. It's been a huge undertaking across the globe, but it sets the framework for us to move forward. And this, like I said, it's just the beginning. There's an enormous amount of work to be done going forward in the next stages of this project.
And when you're saying all that, I was thinking, I mean, the impact of a family of four going out on their boat for a week that's based in Sydney, and they might take it up to Palm Beach for the week, and they might hang out at Refuge Bay or somewhere like that for a week. Their impact on the environment in doing that, as opposed to flying somewhere overseas, is so little. So it's actually really important that we keep boating available for two people, because we all know going on a boat for a week can feel like you've been somewhere else for 2 weeks because of that time lapse that seems to occur on boats, which is the whole Blue Mind concept. But it's actually really important that we keep boating available to as many people as possible, because, like you say, it changes their lives. It makes them feel so good, and we don't want to lose that. I mean, I think we've had enough impact on our mental well-being with COVID-19. We don't want to take away boating as well. You know, that would be tragic, wouldn't it?
Oh, and look, it's unfathomable. It just can't. It can't happen. It won't happen. We will, you know, because we have to. You know, we have to ensure that access to these wonderful waterways are protected. For a whole range of different people. You know, it's, you know, from paddleboards to super yachts. You know, that's from the sort of range of things we're doing. But I guess, you know, the other thing that I think is important as part of this is that this study isn't one-dimensional. It identifies a whole range of different, because there's so much data in it, there's so many ways that you can look at it. And I guess the emerging use types, for instance, like syndicated ownership, like clubs like Freedom Boat Club and those sorts of, you know, ways of going boating where multiple people can get access to a single vessel. Well, again, that's providing a pathway for people to get into recreational boating, but at the same time, you're dividing the carbon footprint of the product itself by the number of people that are actually using it. So whether it's syndication or clubs or charter or those sorts of elements, you know, the greater utilization of the craft is also another way to decarbonize the industry, because your per capita carbon footprint is reduced. And so all of these, you know, these processes form part of this pathway, as does elements outside the scope of the study, for instance, hull efficiencies, so material choices, foiling alternatives for fast craft.
That's all very of these exciting things. Technology, isn't it? Foiling.
It is. And I think that the efficiencies that can be gained from foiling, but again, foiling is about going a bit faster,
yep.
Right? So if you want to go faster, foiling technologies provide you a very efficient way to reduce the friction. You know, as I said before, that 10 times the amount of, you know, to push a boat through the water requires a lot of energy to get it up on the foils and get it, you know, once it's up on the foils, it's very efficient through the water. So there's a whole range of different things that form the bigger sustainability picture. But this decarbonisation study was about addressing, I guess, a very large issue that the world is facing. In other words, how do we arrest and reduce the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere to be able to minimise and reverse, ideally, climate change?
Yeah, which is why so important it's done by somebody like ICOMIA that brings so many different people together, because it's all industry people that can come up with all of those different solutions to assist the whole process, isn't it?
Well, the benefit that we've got is that we have access to the best technologies from around the world, that we have from the best experts from around the world, and this is what ICOMIA is about. It's about collaboration. It's about bringing the brightest minds in our industry together with the appropriate resources to actually deliver an outcome, because this is operating, you know, this study is of a scale that would be extremely difficult for any one marine industry association to undertake in their own right. And given that the supply chains for our industry and most industries are truly global, that you actually need to access the data sets from all over the world to be able to produce a study of this type. So in that regard, you can really only do it as a global study for it to be genuinely meaningful to actually reduce carbon. And so I think that's one of the major benefits of what we've been able to achieve.
So I guess to conclude on a couple of things, with the current boat owners, can we talk to them specifically about a couple of things they can do to make a difference almost immediately?
Sure. So I think, like all things, it's about, you know, if you want your boat to be efficient, so, you know, reducing your carbon footprint in a lot of sense is always about efficiency. So maintain your boat, maintain your engines, keep your hull clean. That's going to improve your fuel efficiency, as a consequence, going to reduce your carbon footprint. It's also thinking about what you're doing. You know, in a lot of sense, you know, boating's about getting out and recreating with friends. So if you're just going out for a cruise to go somewhere to go for a swim, then you don't need to particularly go fast. Just take your time, you know, because you'll save some money, which is particularly good. But absolutely, at the same time, you reduce your carbon footprint. But, you know, there are other things where if you're doing tow sports, all those sorts of things, then again, it's just keeping your boat as efficient as possible to make it as effective as possible. The industry more broadly will be focusing on these pathways for sustainable fuels. As a consequence, we'll have to work very closely with the engine manufacturers to get them to be satisfied with the types of fuels and to warrant the engines for those types of fuels and all those sorts of things. So there's a huge body of work that needs to be worked through in that regard, but we now know what to do. And I think that, so, you know, we'll be communicating to the consumers about what the future looks like. We'll also be we'll be communicating to the industry. So for marinas, for instance, they can take, I guess, some comfort in the reality that the existing infrastructure that they have for the storage and dispensing of liquid fuels will be suitable for the future. So, you know, that scenario is that if you've got to replace a fuel tank, well, it's worth replacing.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be redundant in 5 or 10 years' time. And I think those sorts of key messages are part of the work that we are that we're progressing with right now.
And I guess some marinas are in locations that they can't necessarily up their power supply dramatically to allow all electrical boats to be there either. So they'd be a little bit more a little less scared, if you like, now too.
So I think that it's interesting, because I think there is definitely, electric boats are part of the picture. As I said before, there's no one size fits all. But based on the current research, I can't envisage a scenario where all the boats in the marina in any sense will be electric. They'll be predominantly Their energy source will be sustainable fuels. There'll be more electric vehicles, so marinas will need to accommodate vehicle charging points and all those sorts of elements. But and that does impact on infrastructure design, and you know, because if you go and build a marina today, you're building it for the 50 years. You're not building it for 5 years or 10 years. You're buying good quality infrastructure that lasts for a long time, and so you need to think about what you need to accommodate in that infrastructure. And so I think that we've got a pretty clear picture as to what the future looks like now.
And I know that we've mentioned a couple of times that super yachts haven't been included in this study, and that's because they're a different usage profile to what recreational boats are. Obviously, they can use this information for their toys and their smaller boats and their tenders and all that sort of thing, can't they?
Absolutely.
In terms of the future of Icomia, is Icomia wanting to do more studies in, for example, taking in that space, or what's the future there?
So we're looking to work with the broader industry, and there's been a lot of work done by the superyacht sector themselves in this particular area. And just to give you an example, most superyachts have engine hours more than 1,000 hours a year. As an example, and things like that. So it's a different usage profile, and it depending on the scale of them as to whether they're closer to recreational boats or closer to ships, depending on how big they are, of course, they can look at different technologies. And so we actually see that there is an opportunity to expand as another stage into vessels above 24 metres, certainly as a study. But that'll be driven by the superyacht industry itself in some respects as to what they want and how they want to move forward with that. So there certainly is a process of engagement in that regard. Likewise, having only just launched this report in the last couple of weeks, it takes a little time for the broader industry to digest it. And I think that we'll find that the industry will come back and say, well, look, we'd like to explore this more. We want you to focus on this. And we'll build effectively a stage two project based on the feedback that we receive from industry as well as from policymakers. And then build some collaborations about doing those projects.
So that's exciting. So thank you so much for being here today and discussing this all with all of our audience and giving them some real insight as to what the boating industry is doing to I guess work out what the future holds. It's really exciting.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's a big topic and it's a complex topic, and I guess the challenge is how do you distill it 558-page technical report down into sort of a short summary. But
talking of which, you can actually get hold of the report, am I right?
Yeah.
How do people do that?
So you can either get hold of the report by going to your, if you're in industry, then you go to your MIA, your Marine Industry Association in your country, and they can support you with that through their membership of Icomia. There is an executive summary available to anyone. We have a website called propellingourfuture.com, and there's an executive summary of that report on there. And that's got a lot of detail in it. It'll actually show you the comparative LCA carbon of the 9 different craft types. So that's a really great place to start to actually get an understanding of it.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being here. It's been a good chat. I hope you guys have all enjoyed listening to this. It's been quite a long one because we've had quite a lot to cover, but I think it's a really important subject that really needs to be discussed and spoken about. I really appreciate Icomia putting that massive effort and suspect a fair amount of funding into that. Yeah. So thanks so much, Darren, for being here. Any other points you'd like to make to the listeners before we go?
No, I just really appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk about it. I think that's, this is a topic that everyone needs to talk about, that we're here to try and get the information out there to stimulate conversations around this, to get people thinking so that we can work together for a better future for the industry as a whole, for the boating community as a whole, and for the broader community.
Thanks so much, Darren. And we'll see you on the water soon. And if you'd like further information and you're in the boating industry, contact your MIA association in your country, or you can go to propellingourfuture.com. That site will be continue to be a resource for both the boating industry and legislators to see what the boating industry is doing to make change and propel into our future. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. It's always great to have your ears on board. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you on the water soon.